Talk about whiplash. Here is a scene where Jesus walks on water, comes to the boat when a wind is howling enough to affect the boat's progress, calms the disciples' understandable fright, apparently induces the wind to stop, but the narrator cites their being astounded not by any of that. What the disciples did not understand, because of their hardness of heart, had to do with the loaves, not the incredible things they had just experienced.
The Bible is full of stories that we all know and love. But how well do we know them? The answer might surprise you. The Bible you thought you knew is going to dive deep into the exquisite details of the biblical stories that make them fascinating and transforming.
In this week's podcast, we're going once more to deal with a New Testament text. Specifically, I'm going to treat the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verses 30 through 52, and chapter 8, verses 1 through 21. I realize that podcasts are an audio medium, but if possible, let me encourage you to read the passage before listening, or if this is inconvenient, read the text after you have listened. In this passage, we get Mark's version of Jesus' miraculous feeding of a large crowd. Do I sense disappointment in this introduction? Is this one of those stories that is so familiar that it is impossible to say anything fresh? I've heard this account 1,000 times in Sunday school and heard sermons on it more times than I care to remember. No offense intended, but hearing it one more time is a cure for insomnia. Indeed, this story is so well known that we can recite it by heart. Jesus and the disciples have attracted a crowd, which Jesus addresses. But Jesus goes on too long. It gets late, and the people become hungry. There is no food close by, and it is too costly to feed such a large group. Some kid happens to have a lunch consisting of bread and fish, so Jesus blesses these ingredients and has the disciples distribute them to the multitude. Everyone had plenty to eat. There was even extra when they were done. The crowd and the disciples were amazed at Jesus' miracle. Then the story ends. Now, it may seem a little cynical to dismiss any miracle, but that is how familiar this story has become. And we all know that familiarity breeds contempt. Meaning no disrespect to Jesus, we admit it was a sensational display, but we have long since exhausted what this story has to offer. You'll pardon me if I beg to differ. Let's take another look and pay attention to the details. I've been insisting since the beginning of these podcasts that the details make all the difference. When we get the details on the table, I'll let you be the judge whether there is more to this text than meets the eye. The episode begins after the apostles have been on a short-term mission and return to Jesus with a report. That's in verse 30 of chapter 6. They told him what they had done and what they had taught. Jesus did not respond to this report. Instead, he suggested that they go someplace where they could rest for a while. That's in verse 31. Almost immediately, however, our ears perk up because of where Jesus said they should go. Many translations have a lonely place, but the actual word is Hermon, tapon. A desert place. One need not know where exactly Jesus had in mind, but the phrase desert place is pregnant with biblical meaning. Remember that the desert or wilderness, Hebrew midbar, looms in the Old Testament narrative. Israel spent 40 years in a midbar, or Hermon, when they left Egypt on the way to the Promised Land. That was not merely a description of geography or terrain. The wilderness had to do with fear, anxiety, temptation, and limited resources. It was a frightening place. Remember, too, that one of the incidents with which Israel had to cope was a dearth of water and food. Wilderness has a huge role in the Old Testament story. Equally, wilderness figures in the later part of the story as well. The Assyrians and Babylonians deported some Israelites when they forced them into exile after the destruction of the northern and southern kingdoms, respectively. That meant Israel had to traverse a wilderness on the way to Assyrian and Babylonian captivity. When almost three generations later, the Babylonian exile was terminated, Israelites once more crossed a wilderness on the return trip to Jerusalem and other locations in the Promised Land. One cannot emphasize too much how important wilderness was to the Old Testament saga. It is impossible not to think of that when we hear Jesus tell his disciples that they need to find a wilderness place for a little R&R. We will soon see whether these allusions to the wilderness throughout the Bible materialize. In any case, Jesus and the disciples head out in a boat to find this desert place. That's in verse 32 of chapter 6. In the meantime, many got wind of this and ran to the desert place beforehand. The rest Jesus and his disciples were looking for was going to have to be postponed. Once Jesus saw this throng, his compassion led him to regard these people as sheep without a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. That's in verses 33 and 34 of chapter 6. It takes time to teach many things, which explains how it got late. At that point, the disciples went to Jesus and told him, "This place is a desert," as though he had forgotten. That's in verse 35. This was the third time a desert place is mentioned, underscoring its significance in this narrative. Noting not only the place but the time, the disciples have a solution to what they perceived as a dilemma. Send the people away where they could purchase food. Not having food in the desert place echoes Israel's hunger when they experienced the wilderness when they fled Egypt. But Jesus had another idea. "You give them something to eat," he said. That's in verse 37. Flabbergasted, the disciples respond by complaining that that would be too expensive. Upon hearing this gripe, Jesus moves rapidly to plan B. He wanted the disciples to check on whether there was any food supply on hand. After a search, the disciples managed to come up with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. That's in verse 38. No kid with a lunch in Mark's version of the story. Jesus then ordered the crowd to sit down in groups of hundreds and fifties, after which he blessed the food, gave it to the disciples, and had them distribute it. That's verse 41. Jesus seems to have divided the fish himself. Not only was the crowd able to have a bite, there was more than enough for everyone. In fact, 12 baskets of broken pieces of bread and some fish were left over. That's in verse 43. Just in case we did not realize how spectacular this desert feast was, the narrator reminds us that the crowd consisted of 5,000 men, which assumes, if we add women and children, an even larger crowd. That's in verse 44. It is hard to know how much time elapsed between this incident and a similar one. If one accounts for a few temporal references and the time it would take to travel to places mentioned, it would be anywhere from a handful of days to a couple of weeks. But not too long at all. In terms of narrative space, only a chapter and a half later, Jesus, the disciples, and a crowd find themselves once again in a haramon, a wilderness or desert. That's in verse 4 of chapter 8. Here is the scene. A great crowd has gathered, which is an interesting redundancy. Then the narrator informs us not only that they had had nothing to eat, but appears that the crowd had not eaten for 3 days. This time, though, the disciples do not inform Jesus of the dire situation. Instead, Jesus summons his disciples to explain the problem. Jesus gets to the point right away. "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come a long way." That's in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 8. Jesus's having compassion on the crowd is typical. That mirrors his first reaction to the earlier crowd in verse 34 of chapter 6. What is different, though, is that the crowd had been with Jesus for 3 days. It is no wonder that Jesus thought some of them would faint on the way home, especially those who had traveled far. How will the disciples respond to what Jesus said? Here is what we might have expected. "Lord, no worries. Someone in the crowd might have a little something which you can bless so that we can have an endless supply. Remember the last time we were in that desert place? That was great. We fed over 5,000 people. Recall that when we complained that there was not enough money to purchase food for a group that size, you told us to give them something to eat. We did as you said, and the results were sensational. There is no reason why we cannot duplicate that again." "Alas," the disciples said, "no such thing, not even close." Rather, they asked pathetically, "How can one feed these men bread here in the desert?" That's in verse 4 of chapter 8. This response is nothing short of perplexing. Were the disciples suffering from amnesia? Had their brains become mush? How could they have forgotten so soon what Jesus had accomplished only a short time ago? For that matter, how could anyone have witnessed that miraculous feeding and ever forget the rest of one's natural life? At least the disciples were being biblical. In Psalm 78, a recalcitrant and faithless Israel put this question to God: "Can God spread a table in the wilderness?" That's verse 19 of Psalm 78. The disciples imitated Israel to a T with their question to Jesus. Thankfully, we are not told that Jesus groaned. Instead, Jesus dealt with their question by asking one himself: "How many loaves do you have?" Without hesitation, the disciples replied, 7. Now, remember in the prior incident, Jesus told the disciples to check with the crowd to see whether they could muster up a little food. This time, the disciples already knew what was available, but that did not prompt them to ask Jesus to bless the bread, after which they would start distributing. Perhaps they could be forgiven the first time for urging Jesus to send the people away to go buy food for themselves. After all, they had never seen Jesus do anything quite like this. But this second time is altogether different. They had witnessed the first feeding, and they already were in possession of 7 loaves this time, which was 2 more loaves than Jesus had at his disposal in the first feeding. If Jesus could bless 5 loaves so that more than 5,000 could be fed, would it not be even easier to bless 7? Curiously, Jesus did not bless these 7 loaves. He only gave thanks for them. That's in verse 6 of chapter 8. Simultaneously, he had the crowd sit down, broke the bread, and had the disciples distribute the food. At this point, we learn that they also had a few fish. That's in verse 7 of chapter 8. It is unclear whether the "they" refers to the disciples or people in the crowd. though the former is likely because the pronoun is plural, which fits with disciples, whereas crowd is singular. If the they is a reference to the disciples, it puts them in an even dimmer light, for it meant that they already had bread and fish, the same ingredients that they had to find in the crowd in the first instance, but unbelievably did not recall what Jesus had done with those victuals previously. In any case, Jesus did bless the fish and had the disciples pass it out to the hungry group. This feeding was also noteworthy. The people ate till full and afterwards gathered 7 baskets of leftovers. That's in verse 8. This time around, the count was only 4,000, a number that was not relegated to men alone. Though fewer ate in the second event in the desert, it was nevertheless impressive. After this picnic in the wilderness, Jesus sent the people away, got in a boat with his disciples, and left. That's in verse 10 of chapter 8. It remains to be seen whether this second miracle made more of an impact on the disciples than the first one did, but we will not have to wait long to know. Following this incident, Jesus had a brief encounter with Pharisees in which they wanted to see a sign from heaven. Jesus saw through this test and refused, indicating in effect that what he had been saying is all they needed. Then he got back on the boat with his disciples. That's in verses 11 through 13 of chapter 8. While on the boat, both feeding stories come immediately to bear. Why? Because the disciples had forgotten to bring enough bread. All they had was one loaf. That's in verse 14 of chapter 8. In the light of the two feeding stories, having only one loaf should have been no problem at all. 5 loaves were multiplied to feed over 5,000 in the first episode, and 7 loaves sufficed for 4,000 in the second episode. One loaf for a handful of men should not have raised any concern whatsoever. Plus, Jesus was with the disciples on the boat. Had they not witnessed up close what he had done with small amounts of bread in the face of such large crowds? Apparently intuiting their perplexity, Jesus cautioned his disciples by warning them about the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Leaven, of course, is another word for yeast, a prime ingredient for making bread. But what do these enigmatic phrases mean? What exactly is the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod? The Pharisees were a prominent form of Jewish religious expression and were often at odds with Jesus over interpretations of Jewish tradition or scripture. Herod was a Jewish official, even a king of sorts, though because of Roman occupation and sovereignty, his authority was derived. He collaborated with the Roman government and therefore was often despised by Jews who were under the thumb of Roman rule. Again, to what was Jesus referring when he made these strange comments? Was Jesus somehow saying that both religious Jews, represented by Pharisees, or Jews who had colluded with the hated Roman government, represented by Herod, could only offer yeast rather than bread to the people? Leaven was necessary for bread's production, but by itself did not provide nourishment. Or did Jesus have something else in mind? There are biblical references that suggest leaven or yeast symbolize evil, or at least something undesirable, since it can ferment. For example, a cereal offering with leaven is, according to Leviticus chapter 2, verse 11, inappropriate. St. Paul sees leaven as a symbol of malice or evil when he admonishes the church at Corinth to get rid of old yeast and replace it with new. That's in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. Perhaps Jesus uses leaven or yeast, which is an ingredient that suffuses all the bread and therefore is symbolic of outlooks or attitudes that are thorough, permeating, and stifling. That seems most likely when we consider Jesus' reaction to the fact that his disciples paid no attention at all to what he had just said about the Pharisees or Herod. Instead, upon hearing that, they turned to each other and discussed among themselves as follows, quote, "We have no bread," end of quote. That's in verse 16 of chapter 8. Do not forget for a moment that that was not factually correct. They had one loaf and had quite recently witnessed Jesus feeding two sizable crowds with 5 and 7 loaves, respectively. In terms of ratio, feeding over 5,000 with 5 loaves or 4,000 with 7, one loaf for one small group of disciples should have constituted absurd abundance. Not once did this dawn on the disciples. As it turns out, Jesus gives us the key to what he meant by the leaven of the Pharisees or Herod. It had to do with perception and understanding. Here is why I think that. Recall that after the first feeding account in chapter 6, the disciples left the area by boat. I did not mention this incident at first, but it is important to bring it up now. Jesus did not leave with the disciples. Instead, he went to a mountain to pray. That's in verse 46 of chapter 6. By evening, Jesus was still on land by himself. That's in verse 47. But he had a vantage point from which he could see the disciples' boat and observe that it was dealing with a headwind. That's in verse 39. At that point, Jesus walked toward the boat right on the sea. That's in verse 48. It is unclear what Jesus had in mind because he thought he would pass by the boat. But the disciples saw something that they believed was a ghost. That's in verse 49. Terrified, they cried out. In response, Jesus spoke to the disciples, telling them not to be afraid. Then he changed his mind and got into the boat, which was when the wind stopped blowing. That's in verse 51 of chapter 6. At this juncture, the narrative says something mind-blowing. The disciples were astounded. That's in verse 51. That makes sense, as they had just thought that they were encountering a ghost, only discover that it was Jesus walking on water. Who would not be astounded? But the narrative does not tie the disciples' astonishment to this matter of Jesus seeming to be a ghost or walking on the water. Rather, the narration links their being amazed to their not understanding about the loaves, since their hearts were hardened. That's in verse 52 of chapter 8. Talk about whiplash. Here is a scene where Jesus walks on water, comes to the boat when a wind is howling enough to affect the boat's progress, calms the disciples' understandable fright, apparently induces the wind to stop, but the narrator cites their being astounded not by any of that. What the disciples did not understand, because of their hardness of heart, had to do with the loaves, not the incredible things they had just experienced. Saying that hardness of heart distorts perception is an understatement of biblical proportions, given what had just happened. Jesus brings up the topics of perceiving and understanding after this second feeding, in response to the disciples' grumbling about the bread. He says specifically, quote, "Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened?" End quote. Jesus wants to know how the disciples have eyes but cannot see. They have ears but seem unable to hear. In these two comments, there are allusions to wilderness stories and a common prophetic motif. The allusions to Israel's struggles in the wilderness are triggered by the hardness of heart language. That same language does not occur in the Old Testament in terms of Israel. It does in relation to Pharaoh. But there is a semantic equivalent. The semantic equivalent occurs when Israel is being accused of being stiff-necked. This odd phrase is found in Exodus chapter 32, verse 9, chapter 33, verses 3 and 5, chapter 34, verse 9, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 6 and 13, and then chapter 31, verse 27. Sometimes this is missed because the phrase is translated stubborn. Indeed, that is an appropriate translation. Still, it literally means stiff-necked. Israel was stiff-necked or stubborn on more than one occasion during their 40-year trek. The allusions to prophetic language are found in Isaiah chapter 6, verses 9 through 10, where God tells Isaiah to address Israel by saying, "Go and say to this people, hear and hear, but do not understand. See and see, but do not perceive." Right after this, one encounters language about making a heart fat, ears heavy, and eyes shut. Again, these are metaphors about the inability to perceive, even when ordinary organs of perception are physically present and functioning. Seeing requires more than eyes. Hearing requires more than ears. Jeremiah expresses the same sentiments in chapter 5, verse 21, as does Ezekiel in chapter 12, verse 2. As though these accusations were not enough, Jesus asks pointedly, "Do you not remember?" That is a rhetorical question, for clearly they had not remembered in the most important sense. Had they remembered, then their eyes would have seen and their ears would have heard. Their hearts would have been open and accepting, rather than hardened. This was not a matter of sensory organs, it was a matter of internal spiritual disposition. Jesus fleshes out this question with specifics. Quote, "Don't you remember what I did with the 5 loaves and the 5,000? How much was left over?" Despite the rhetorical flavor of Jesus' question, the disciples responded just the same. 12 baskets remained. That's in verse 19 of chapter 8. They also gave the right answer when Jesus quizzed them about the second feeding of the 4,000. And how many leftovers remained? 7, they said. The episode concludes with one more question to which the disciples say absolutely nothing. Do you not yet understand? The answer is all too obvious. These stories focus on Jesus' disciples. They say virtually nothing about the reactions of the crowd who benefited from the miraculous feeding. The disciples saw what had happened, but did not absorb it. That is, they saw with their eyes, but not with their hearts. Surely they heard what Jesus was teaching. They had previously taught themselves, but the teaching had not penetrated. They had heard with their ears, but had not sunken in to where it counted. Biblical miracle stories are not a form of God saying, "Pick a card, any card." The signs and miracles are not divine sleights of hand or designed to impress or make scientists blush. They are indicative of God's work at a much deeper level, a level that feeds not only the body, but the soul. For now, at least, the disciples did not yet get it. Perhaps in time, they will. I want to thank you so very much for listening to The Bible You Thought You Knew. I have a question for you.
Do you have a question or topic that you'd like me to cover on the podcast? If so, all you need to do is head over to Apple Podcasts and do two simple things. One, leave a rating and review telling me what you think of the podcast. Two, in that review, ask anything you want related to the Bible. That's all you have to do. Then, listen in to hear your question answered on a future episode. Join us next time on The Bible You Thought You Knew when we discuss Jesus' personal Bible. God bless.